This is Steve Blount, and you are listening to the Live from Irish Arts Centre podcast, bringing you closer to live Irish arts in New York City. For more information, visit irishartscentre.org.
Welcome to the Irish Arts Centre for our evening with Johanna Lane to celebrate the launch of her debut novel, Black Lake. Quick housekeeping, please take this moment to silence your cell phones and note that there is an emergency door to your left, but for any non-emergency entrances and exits, please use the door through which you entered the theater. Black Lake opens with a quote from Brideshead Revisited. "I regarded men as something much less than the buildings they made and inhabited, as mere lodgers in short-term sublessees of small importance in the long, fruitful life of their homes." Black Lake is a tragic and haunting portrait of a family torn asunder when this very conceit bears devastatingly true for the Campbell family and their estate at Duloc. From page one, you're subsumed into the landscape by Johanna's magnificent ability for detail, and as the story of John, Marianne, Philip, and Kate unfolds. Author Josh Weil says of the novel, "In Lane's hands, the smallest details bloom with meaning. The quietest moments resonate with the power of truth." Johanna grew up in Ireland with a summer home in Donegal that became the inspiration for her first novel. She began writing in her final year at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland, where she was the recipient of the Hemingway Prize for Fiction and the Robert T. Jones Graduate Fellowship, which supports St. Andrews students who go on to graduate study in the U.S. In New York, she received her MFA at Columbia University, interned in the fiction department at The New Yorker, and in her 13 years here, she has taught creative writing at Columbia, CUNY, and Yeshiva University. Along with her first novel, it is impressive. Along with her first novel, which is now available in the gallery, she has written for The Believer, The Daily Beast, The Irish Times, Nylon Magazine, and Publishers Weekly. Johanna will read from Black Lake before Kevin Houlihan, author of The Brothers' Lot, joins her on stage for a conversation. We will then open up the floor for Q&A, and following that, I hope you'll join us for some refreshments in the gallery in celebration of today's publication date for Black Lake. So without further ado, I'd like to welcome to the stage Johanna Lane.
Thanks, Rachel, and thanks so much to the Irish Arts Centre for all their hard work. Thank you all so much for coming. Thank you so much to Kevin Houlihan, who will join me on stage after I've read. I had the pleasure of reading his book, The Brothers' Lot, in the past month, and I can't recommend it enough. So go out and buy The Brothers' Lot as soon as you can. I'm going to read to you from the middle of the book. And it's from the perspective of the mother, Marianne. "When John announced that he thought it was time I visit Duloc, I was flattered that he wanted to show me where he was from. By that stage, he'd been to my parents often for dinner. My mother could see that I was quite serious about him, so she wasn't worried about my disappearing for a week of the Easter holidays up to Donegal with my young man, as my father called him. The drive up was great fun, just the two of us in his car, leaving the city, stopping for sandwiches, zipping through all those little towns in the middle of Ireland, where you'd wonder how people didn't die of ennui, that was the sort of word I might have been guilty of using then, and through the border. The soldiers made us completely unpack the car whilst they searched it. When I asked them jokingly how we looked suspicious, one of them fixed me with a stare and insisted it was random. But it upset me, the whole thing. I'd never been through the north before, and I felt exposed, having our possessions removed from John's car and laid out beside it. Not that they'd opened our bags, not that they'd been anything but polite, but it soured the journey for me, and I asked John if he'd ever thought of going around by Sligo to avoid that sort of thing. Actually, that's never happened before, he assured me, bemused at my indignation. They have a pretty awful life, he added. I felt I was being rebuked for my reaction. I was quiet all the way through Enniskillen and well past the border between Fermanagh and Donegal. For the first time, I was rethinking our relationship. I was angry at him for his calm forbearance as the soldier searched his car, at his diffident smile, at his lack of understanding as to why it had made me feel so strange. My anger grew the further we went. I considered telling him that I'd changed my mind, that he should turn the car around. I wanted to go back to Dublin. But there's a point somewhere in Donegal where you suddenly realize you've left everything behind. You're on the road in the middle of nowhere, turf bogs on either side, and beyond them the steep sides of the valley. No one dares to build there anymore. Only the ruins of famine houses appear now and again. There are no trees, and the earth has a scorched look to it, as if a fire passed through a long time ago. Later I learnt that the fire was wind. I still don't know whether it was by design, so eager was he that I see the Poison Glen at its best, that we turned onto the road when dusk was beginning. I simply forgot I was angry with him, the landscape was so beautiful. At the end of the road, a set of gates loomed ahead of us. John got out and dragged them open. I wanted to help, but he waved at me to stay in the car. He was well used to opening them, I could see that. I'd no idea until that moment where he'd come from. I knew there were people like him hidden around the countryside, but I hadn't given them a moment's thought in my life. I remember my heart convulsing slightly when he turned onto the avenue and drove along by the lake before bringing the car to a halt in front of the house with as little ceremony as possible. All his actions were muted, as if he was trying to use his body to offset the grandeur of the place itself. He turned to me nervously. "Here we are." Unlike the landscape, the house itself wasn't so much beautiful as it was imposing. I looked from John to the place he'd grown up and tried to reconcile the two. The impression he gave of being a little cut off from everyone else in Dublin made sense now. I could see that he was very different from us, that his experience of Ireland had not been our experience, that we'd grown up in different countries. But of course, that realization was subconscious. All I consciously felt was fear. I was the one in my element in Dublin. Without any warning, the tables had been turned. "Well, come on then," he said, and went around to open the boot. While his back was to the front door of the house, a woman emerged. It was Mrs. Connolly, more robust then, straight-backed. The arthritis that took up residence in her later years had not yet arrived. She opened the door with such authority that I forgot John's mother had died and assumed it must be her. John turned when he heard the sound of the door opening, dropping our bags on the gravel, and went to greet her. She rebuffed his embrace kindly and instead stood still, holding each of his hands in her own, arms outstretched, so that she could get a good look at him. Then her head popped to one side and found my gaze through the car window. It was unfortunate, I recognize now, that the first time I met her, I'd only just realized what a grand boyfriend I had, because my face must have still registered the shock. John introduced me not as his girlfriend, but as his friend, Marianne. This startled me anew. It felt like a double rejection. On top of the fact that it was possible I might not be posh enough to have a boyfriend with a house like this, he was suddenly unsure I was his girlfriend. Of course, I understood later, as I became more accustomed to his world, that he never would have said girlfriend at Duloc. It would have been too forward, would have suggested too much. I wish I'd understood that at the time, though. As Mrs. Connolly led us to the house, John seemed very concerned for her well-being after his mother's death, much more concerned than for his own. He asked about Francis, too, that lovely, quiet man I was yet to meet. It would be years before he and I had a proper conversation. The hall has never been Duloc's best feature, being dark and, I think, messily designed, with too many doors and corridors sprouting off it, and I hope that perhaps the house wasn't as grand as all that, that the outside had been misleading. As we ascended the stairs, I looked at the huge tapestry hanging on the wall halfway up. It was a hunting scene, but one in which, and this feeling grew in me the longer I lived at Duloc, I couldn't help but feel that the fox was getting away as it leapt exuberantly out of the picture, whilst the men lagged behind on their horses, looking slightly lost. In the distance, on a hill, I could just about make out a stag, its antlers outlined against the brown sky. On the landing, there was an endless set of doors leading to unseen rooms. The scale of Duloc washed over me completely then. The terraced house I'd grown up in could have fitted into this one many times over. "I loved the room Mrs. Connolly put me in, and after I saw all the others opening and closing each door secretly over the course of my stay, I came to understand that she'd put me in one of the nicest, one of only two with a view of the gardens and beyond them the island and the sea. It had a sage green carpet that had seen better days and lovely rose gold wallpaper with swirls like the tops of Roman columns repeated again and again. All the furniture was heavy mahogany, the big smooth wardrobe, the bedside table, the writing desk in the bay window. There was a fireplace behind the door, but I could see that there hadn't been a fire in a long time. I couldn't wait to unpack my things and get settled. I loved it. I loved it straight away, and I wish I hadn't stifled that. I wish I hadn't been too aware of my own background to show them how I felt. It would have done a lot of good in the moment. "I'll leave you to get settled," John said, and disappeared with Mrs. Connolly off down the landing. I went to the window and looked out. Below was not one garden, but a series of gardens, each with its own theme. Some were luscious, almost overgrown, others stark, austere, more like the Jardin de Luxembourg than anything else. I still can't take in the fact that at the same time as Philip I was designing those gardens, he was evicting family after family from their homes on the estate. But of course, I didn't find out about them until much later. After John and I got married, I ordered a statue of the Buddha from India, not so much out of any beliefs of my own, but because of the exoticism of it, and because by then I had learned something of the man who built the house. The Buddha's smiling face seemed the perfect counter to Philip I's Presbyterianism. I'm embarrassed by that now, at the ostentation of shipping the thing all the way from India to Donegal, but in my defense, I knew nothing of the real state of our finances. I got my first glimpse of Francis as I stood there, the last of the light drifting out to sea, the sun gathering it back in. Francis has always moved more quickly outside, whether the indoor saps his energy or whether it's deference to the sudden set of codes that descend on us in a house like Duloc, I don't know. But I remember that evening he moved like a young man, lean, quick, at that point under the trees where the day has just turned to night. I wasn't to meet him on that visit. I was introduced to him only when John and I were engaged, once Francis knew that I was to be, in his eyes, mistress of Duloc. I remember being insulted by this at the time, as if I wasn't worth meeting until he knew I was a fixture. But now that I know him well, I appreciate this quality in him, the recognition of permanence. Perhaps it's because he was brought up here, a place where the landscape is nothing if not that. In the evening, we had dinner in the dining room. Without my knowing, John had insisted that Mrs. Connolly leave the cold roast chicken and salads on the sideboard so that he and I could help ourselves when we were ready. It was all part of his plan to ease me into life here. He understood that the house was enough to encounter in one day, and that being served dinner by the housekeeper would have been too much. As I ate the food Mrs. Connolly had prepared for us, no part of me guessed that this wasn't the way things always were. I even insisted on washing up, and John, to his great credit, acquiesced, even though he'd probably never spent any time at that sink in his life. I should have realized, because he didn't know where anything went once I'd dried it. I like to think the washing up was one of the things I did right that week, that Mrs. Connolly would have known John only did it under my influence, and that I had no intention of getting too big for my boots just because I was going out with the owner of Duloc. That night I read very late, the stillness of the house settling in around me. At one point I put the book down and listened. I'd never been completely alone in silence before. I was a little afraid. The only other living being, John, was quite far away. His childhood bedroom was at the other end of the landing. The Connollys had retreated to their cottage, of course, which is something else I hadn't expected. I must have fallen asleep not long after this realization, but when I woke it was pitch black and John was climbing into bed beside me, his feet frozen after the trip across the landing. I was unrealistic about what it would be like to live here. That first visit was all awe, and the second, just after John and I got engaged, was play acting. It was only when I came to live at Duloc after our honeymoon, during our first night together in John's parents' former bedroom, whilst my new husband slept soundly beside me, that I began to consider the enormity of how my life had changed. He was different when we settled down after the wedding. On my first visits, we had spent all our time together, rambling in the mountains, lolling about in the drawing room. Once we were man and wife, he was up and out before I woke, to where I don't know, but I didn't feel I had a right to say anything. I still thought he was doing me a favor by marrying me and bringing me to this place. Thanks.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
I have to really say, the kind of fiction that I particularly like is something that immerses me in a world that isn't mine and is so filled with internal coherence that it kind of creates a truth of its own that is possibly more coherent than trying to deal with some of the things you deal with if you're like trying to write an extended essay. And just in terms of how crafted it is, how long did this take you?
An embarrassingly long time. I got the idea for the book in 2003 when I had to come up with a thesis project at Columbia. And I started doing some reading about the Anglo-Irish around then, and I thought this subject would be a good way of examining a lot of my preoccupations slash obsessions. And so, I mean, really more than 10 years ago, I started thinking about it. And it's kind of percolated over a lot of that time.
And the shape of it now, how did that evolve? Like the alternating points of view, the shifts?
The first part of the book I wrote was from the perspective of the child, Philip, who's 8. And I was much younger, so I was much closer to an 8-year-old then when I started writing it. And then I wrote his father's perspective, John, and then I came up with a mother's perspective when I was a little older myself. And then I wrote the epilogue, and then I wrote the prologue. But it was really a lot of trial and error. It was my first book, and I had no idea how to structure a book. And it was really the idea that I couldn't imagine starting a book from one person's point of view and just going the whole way to the end. So this seemed like a more manageable, bite-sized, you know, way of doing it. And then I got really interested in the idea of truth and hearing characters tell the different events from their own points of view and what kind of satisfaction that might be able to give the reader when they know really more than anyone else, certainly more than the characters.
Right. We chatted before earlier last week. One of the things that you said that struck me was we were talking about the importance of physical space, and one of the things you said was how valued a room of one's own was, which led me to wonder how and when or where do you actually write?
I've written absolutely everywhere, really, at this point. The place that I really sort of, when I lived here, you know, solidly for 13 years, the place I really ended up going every day was Paragraph, the writers' collective on 14th Street.
Right.
And I really liked that because it's this room full of other writers, but they can't talk to you and they can't answer their phones. But you know that everyone's kind of buzzing away with their own writing, and there's a really nice energy to that, you know. And it also means you have to get out of your pajamas, because if you stay at home and write, there's a real danger it gets to 3 o'clock and you're still in your pajamas and you haven't brushed your teeth, and your husband says, that's kind of disgusting. So that's the main place I've written. But I've written, so many borrowed houses all the way from Ireland to LA to Indonesia to coffee shops. And I'm really unreasonable when I'm writing too. If there's people in a coffee shop talking, which is a much more legitimate thing to be doing in a coffee shop than writing, I really want to go up and tell them to shut up. Of course I don't. I just put in my earphones. I don't.
And there's, to use a cooking analogy, there's two kind of cooks. There's the people who cook a meal and leave the place looking like a bomb hit it, where everything's just all over the place. And there's people who clean as they go.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of writer are you? I mean, when you... Do you hone every single paragraph until it's absolutely perfect and then move on? Or do you just go, bleh, which is kind of my method, and then come back to it when you've forgotten you actually wrote the thing and clean it up?
I think yours is a better method because you actually move forward with your method. You know, it's better to just keep the momentum going. But I'm one of those people who obsesses over a paragraph. And then I think it's perfect, and my husband tells me it's not. And then I pass it on to other people, and then they tell me it's not. So it's a false sense of perfection, too, you know. But I would like to be more like you. And with my next book, I'd really like to try and write the darn thing from beginning to end and then go back and clean it up.
What you do seems to work for you, because one of the things that's really striking about this, and I don't want to mire us in details, but this is a book, and I mentioned this to you, that it would take me a while to read it because I'm a very, very slow reader. But this is one of those books that absolutely rewards slow, careful reading, because there's no... If you draw the reader's eye to something, it's for a very good reason, and it comes back and it gets re-echoed and re-echoed. I think that's one of the really striking things about this.
Thank you.
And you couldn't... How did Did you manage to keep track of all these resonances? Because they're there. There are echoes that it's, and that's that difficulty of telling a story from different points of view and remembering the details that you left out from one person's version to put them in from another. How do you keep track of that?
I don't have any system. I mean, I notice in the Writers Collective, there are people in their little cubicles and they've got post-its all over their things, you know, stuck up. And I don't. I think I'm actually quite obsessive about writing. And I'm quite obsessive about order. And I think I find it really comforting to go back and sort of inhabit something I'm working on and keep trying to impose order. So it's really just going over it again and again and again and again. And then of course there were things I missed, and you know, the fantastic copy editor at Little Brown said, on page 56 you said X, but actually here you said Y. So there's that too. Yeah. But I get a lot of comfort out of going over it again and again, because the world is such a total and utter mess. But you can really, you know, with a book, you can create an order, even if it's an illusion.
The obvious importance of Duloc, the landscape, as it reminded me of the ancient memory strategy of picturing a house and remembering things by remembering. So the memory trick that mm-hmm. people do who mm-hmm. can remember 72 cards or whatever. But this is real. Where did the house and the landscape come from? Because they are so minutely observed and realized.
Well, the landscape is the simpler, easier answer to go with first. And I think looking back now, what happened was that I moved to New York in 2001. And I remember walking down Amsterdam Avenue the first night I got in, and it was August, you know. And it's a stickiness that in Ireland you're just not used to at all. And I'd been on holiday and I'd felt that before, but you can always jump into a pool or the sea or something. I thought, how am I going to live in this place? It's so loud and sticky and hot and all the rest of it. And then September 11th happened 2 weeks later. And honestly, I think I just wanted to spend time in Donegal, you know, in the Donegal landscape, because we spent all our summers there, you know, when I was little still, because my parents bought this lovely old tumbling down house in Donegal. And so for me, there's nowhere in the world as beautiful as Donegal. Mike and I have just been traveling all around Asia, and everyone would say, oh, aren't the hills of Burma beautiful? And I'd be like, they're not Donegal. You know, so I just love the landscape. So I think that's that. And then with the house, the reason I wanted to write about the house was that my mum's family had a beautiful house in Wicklow that I spent a lot of time in as a child. And though it was nothing like on the scale of Duloc, the house I created on the book, the inside of Duloc is based on the inside of that house. And I think that was also a place I wanted to spend time in. And that house is no longer in the family. It was sold when I was 12. And I think this book is partly an elegy for that house too. It's a house where I spent a lot of time with my grandmother and my great aunt. And my great aunt was a teacher. And I remember her setting me up one day in the bay window with her typewriter. And I was really little, I mean, maybe 10, 11, 12. And I remember typing stuff out and thinking, oh, this is pretty good, seeing the things you've written looking, you know, like in a book. And then the other inspiration for the house was this gorgeous estate in Donegal called Glenveagh, which is up in, it's further north than our little house in Donegal. And it's this beautiful estate that was built in the 1850s by this horrible man called John George Adair, who came along and he built this kind of mock castle in this gorgeous, gorgeous valley. And he did actually throw all his tenants off the land just after the famine. And he was cruel enough not just to do that, but then to knock down their cottages with a battering ram. It was really awful. But he did create this beautiful He created this beautiful estate. It's a little bit like, how could someone who is a Nazi write such amazing philosophy, right? You know, how can someone who's so awful create this beautiful place? And so now it's a national park. You can go and visit. And we visited a lot. And I've always loved this place and been really interested in the story. And it seemed like a good place to sort of to set this story, which I realize now has a lot to do with my obsession with space. I think I said to you on the phone last week, I never would have gone to college if I'd had to share a room. I can't imagine sharing a room with some. As my parents will attest, I need my own space very badly. And I can't think of anything worse than this house that you've had in your family for hundreds of years that you feel this, you know, entitlement to and ownership over, suddenly being opened to tourists. It seems, you know, and of course they deserved it, both the real John George Adair and the family in my book. You know, they stole land from Irish people, but or at least got it in a way that wasn't particularly just. But still, strangers roaming your house that has been private. I can't imagine anything worse.
Yeah, no, that really struck me, because my grandmother's house in Clonmel in Tipperary, my aunt lived in it after my grandmother died, and that's where I spent most of my summer as a kid. And just the tiniest little things of it, the sound of a drawer, the sound the door made when the house was sold. It's a very bereft feeling, because you kind of forget things without the objects. I think we do place, there's an associational power of objects and locales and smells. Mm-hmm. And I think the memories can fade if you don't have those things around you. So I think one of the things that sticks out is, this is where the family history lives, in this house, the Campbells. This is their identity. And when it's taken away from them and they move to the cottage, they're really, each one in their own distinct way, is cut adrift.
Yeah.
And they don't ever get together and all sit down and go, I feel really adrift, do you? Yeah, I feel really adrift. They each one is very, very private in how they sort of grieve for the house.
I don't think they really have much family therapy for Anglo-Irish people in Donegal. Maybe if they've been in LA.
So they're very private, they're very incommunicative, but each one, the house is what holds them together to some extent.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And John, the father, he's very emotionally closed off. And he's a character I wanted to write because he's a certain type of Anglo-Irish / sort of posh Englishman, the sort of person who thinks the best thing that you can do is not make a fuss. And that is meant to be noble. And to me, it's incredibly dangerous. It's a very dangerous way of being, this sort of, oh, I don't want to make any ripples, you know, because that means you don't ever deal with anything,
right?
And so all the emotional sort of stasis, or even something more negative than stasis, comes from him. And that kind of ripples out to the others. And try as Marianne, his wife, does, she doesn't really break that down until very extreme things have happened. And I like to think by the end of the book, he's learned that way of being is not a particularly productive way of being.
Right. Because some of the most communicative things in it are written. Like the grandmother's, Olivia's diaries, and then the most forthright piece of communication is the letter that Marianne writes
to
John.
Yeah. Yeah, and Marianne, being from Dublin and being middle class, is a lot more emotionally healthy than him. But she sort of realizes that the only way she's going to get through to him is in this kind of very distilled form of communication, you know. And I mean, I think you and I were joking on the phone last week. Irish people are not, for all our famed talking skills, we're not actually that great at really communicating, or as you say, sitting down and saying, I feel sad today.
No. It brings me to something. the resonances of, like, the history of the Campbells, their relative outsiderness to the larger culture.
Mm-hmm.
You kind of touch on these questions, and then you have Frank Foyle, the local county councillor, who was almost like this sort of atavistic, vengeful, haha, we got it back after all these years.
Yeah.
There's a lot of stuff about who is Irish, how Irish are they? How do you view all of that?
Yeah, I mean, this was definitely a question that really fueled the book, and it was something I had to work out for myself, because when we used to go to Glenveagh, this beautiful big estate in Donegal that's now a national park, there was a video at the beginning, you know, about the history of the estate, and I would always feel incredibly indignant about these people who'd been thrown off their land by Donn Dor D'Adair, and I thought of myself as completely Irish. But then, of course, as I grew up, I came to understand that when you're Protestant in Ireland, a lot of people don't think of you as completely Irish. And I had to sort of think about, I'm trying not to use the words Irish identity, but I was thinking about, mm-hmm. am I really Irish? And the conclusion I've come to 10 years later is, I got swept up in a way of thinking that I think we're a little bit too stuck in often as a country, because the truth is, to be Irish is to be something incredibly, incredibly complex. But for whatever reason, as Irish people, we don't very often want to accept that complexity. I mean, my half-baked theory about this is because when a country is fighting for independence, you can't think about yourselves in a nuanced way. You can't sit around, you know, all the, you know, the revolutionaries can't sit around a table and say, well, if we could just work out a nuanced version of our identity and fight for that, everything will be fine. No, you have to sort of be black and white about it. But I think the fact that that persists into today is some hobbles us, I think, as a country in many ways.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think I thought about this a lot because, I mean, I grew up in Dublin, but being a Dubliner, there was always this weird sensation that you weren't quite Irish enough. Dublin was suspected of being, like, I don't know, a little bit too close to the influence of England. It was it was the Pale.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it always seemed when I was a kid, all the figures of authority were from the country. Mm. All the police, all the priests, all the teachers, they all seemed to come from the country.
You're so very funny about that in your book.
Yeah. So I kind of grew up feeling not authentically Irish enough. Because, I don't know, my half-baked theory on it is that there were lots and lots of insurrections and revolutions, another insurrection and a rising, another rising, and then suddenly one of them worked. And it was like, oh, what do we do now?
Yeah.
And there was this scramble for an iconography. And there was this sort of, you know, Yeats's Lonely Fisherman. Yeah, great, noble peasant. Yeah, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
And this rural ideal that didn't even exist in the countryside at the time became this icon of what it meant to be Irish. And we all failed to live up to that to some extent.
Yeah.
But I don't know, the Queen went to Ireland, Michael D. Higgins did the first presidential visit to England. Is this perhaps moving and evolving?
And we're probably totally the wrong people to answer because we're both living here.
Yeah.
Right? So people might have comments about this in the Q&A section. And the truth is, I don't know the answer to that. And, you know, to add an extra layer to the am I Irish enough question, I would say now that I've lived outside the country for nearly half my life, am I qualified to answer that mm-hmm. question? What do you think?
it's a fascinating thing, and to observe it here in New York, particularly here in the Irish Arts Centre, mm-hmm. when you see, like, the affiliation with something like the St. Pat's for All parade and things like that, where you have little Puerto Rican girls doing Irish dancing, and you kind of go, that's fantastic. So mm-hmm. it has ceased to be quite so much of a monolith.
Here,
there, and it's just, I think the ideas have to move on. And now defining Ireland as anything that's not England is not going to fly anymore.
Right.
So
right.
You got to go somewhere with it, I suppose.
Yeah, it's such a... all of us need rules to live by, I think. I mean, you can't spend every... Or not so much rules as a sort of framework for thinking about ourselves. Because you can't go through every day unmoored, in this... I mean, of course, the only honest position as a human being is, I don't know. You know, I don't know anything, ultimately. And, no one is pure and no one is completely Irish. But there's something in us as human beings that is so resistant to building our lives on that kind of quicksand, which we totally understand. It's totally innate to want to have some identity. You know, I'm a writer who lives in Brooklyn, and that's shorthand for a whole bunch of things that you and I know very well. So you can't really blame people for wanting to have some kind of coherent narrative about themselves. I suppose the question is, when the narrative becomes detrimental to people, to a country, to individuals, how do you break out of it? And I have no idea, I mean, maybe it's immigration in Ireland.
Well, it's the safety valve for political instability for so many years.
Yeah.
But no,
I meant people coming in. I mean, maybe all the people...
Immigration to Ireland.
Yes.
That could be. I mean, the changes that have taken place over the last 20 years could be a new way for it.
Yeah. But it'd be interesting to see what people have to say about this.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Do you have any writers you're afraid of?
Virginia Woolf, but she's dead, thank goodness.
I mean, there are certain writers that I will not read when I'm trying to write something because their influence is so pernicious.
Yeah. Because you admire them so much.
Yes, and they're so good that you start to ape what they do. Are there people you stay away from when you're writing?
Yeah. Although the other side of that too is, I think in the early stages it can be really, especially when you're for your first book, if you're starting out, it can be really helpful to sort of ape someone or a bunch of people and then move away from them, to get you going. But I would say, and I often read poetry when I'm trying to get a book going rather than fiction. But I'd say it's quite dangerous for me to read Michael Ondaatje's early stuff, Amit Chaudhry's novellas. Embarrassingly, Virginia Woolf Anne Enright, because she's so close to the voice that we know so well, and I admire her so much. Who else would be dangerous? Can't think of anyone else in the moment. Who are your dangerous people?
Mr. Beckett's very dangerous.
Oh, yeah.
And... the English writer who died a couple of years ago, Russell Hoban, he wrote Ridley Walker.
No, I don't know him.
He's a sui generis type, but there's an ease about the way he writes that's really deceptive, and it's very easy to slip into.
Mm.
And then there's the usual suspects. Flann O'Brien's very, very dangerous to read too much of.
There's echoes of Flann O'Brien, though, in your book, but not in any kind of derivative way, I think.
I think if Flann O'Brien didn't exist, people in Dublin wouldn't be able to speak.
That's really interesting.
Because there's so much.
Yeah.
Like, the conversation is a competitive sport that goes on in pubs in Dublin. Half of that stuff people should be sued for because they're lifting it mostly from Flann O'Brien.
Do you think that many people are reading Flann?
No, but it's become part of the...
Yeah.
Part of the banter. Mm-hmm. It's part of the sub-language that people speak. Oh, no, I wouldn't be touching that. Oh, God, that's terrible, dangerous, that stuff.
It's all Planet Brian.
It's all, yeah, I think
so. I didn't know that.
Yeah, that's my theory. That's my half-baked theory of that. How did you decide? And this, I think it's very, very brave, and there's not, it's not really a spoiler because we know there's a terrible tragedy at the heart of this
book. Wouldn't
be
an Irish book without a terrible tragedy.
Yeah, but it's front-loaded with terrible tragedy. You get to it very quickly. How did you make that decision? It's a very brave one.
Thank you. That happened really late, actually. Okay, I have to be careful not to say too much too, but I really went through a Virginia Woolf phase in my 20s. And I was really influenced. I know it's a big cliche. I know you're giggling away. I was really influenced into The Lighthouse, the way that Virginia Woolf introduces you to all these characters and they die in parentheses, you know? So it's the opposite of what most novelists strive to do. You know, they work up to the big death, you know, and we're all meant to feel a huge amount of catharsis. And instead, Virginia Woolf introduces you to these characters and then she kills them so quietly and you're just left sort of, you know, reeling. And so I was really interested in the way that she did that and in, excuse me, and in thinking about how I might, I was completely influenced by the way that she did that. So that comes up in the book. But it was a late decision to give away the tragedy in the prologue. And it partly came from some very wise advice from my agent, Eleanor Jackson, who's here this evening, I think. And she didn't actually say this, but I realize now that, of course, once you know that a character has died, when you're reading about them, their life before they died, it just adds this whole, mm-hmm. It's a really simple narrative technique. It just adds this whole extra layer to your encounter with them. And so that was why I gave away the tragedy at the beginning. But it's mainly, again, influenced by Virginia Woolf, a desire to not build up to the tragedy, to not make the tragedy the point of the book.
Right, right.
So to go against what a lot of fiction tries to do. So that's it.
And you play with names quite bravely, too. I mean, the opening of the book, nobody's named for a long time.
Yeah.
It's the mother, the son, the daughter.
Yeah, that was because I really love how close you feel to a character when they haven't got a name. I think he and she and they are you're so much closer to the text than when they've got their actual names. And I really wanted in that short prologue for the reader to feel really close to these people. And by not using their name, I hoped to kind of pull the reader in a bit more. And I was telling you, I think, in an email that I would love to write a novel, and this is where my editor cringes, where you never know anyone's name, you know? Laura, I probably couldn't get away with it. I know that. But the other thing, too, is that naming is so heavy in Ireland.
Yeah, yeah. We talked about that.
Yeah.
It sets up a whole set of expectations, and it's shorthand for a lot.
Yeah.
That you either need to confirm or subvert.
Yeah.
Because there is, like we were talking about that, there's an awful difference if a character walks on and you suddenly tell people that his name is Robert Proudfoot, that's hugely different to saying this is Oisín McGonagall.
Yeah, yeah. And I wanted you to love the characters before you made those decisions about them.
No, it's really effective because it does just draw you in very slowly. And then it's almost quite abrupt and horrible when
the cop
uses their names.
I know.
It's the first one.
I know. Maybe I should have tried the whole thing without any names.
And you arrived at John for
Because it's the most generic male name I could possibly think of. Without any baggage. You can be from any walk of life and any religion in Ireland. Well, actually, that's not true. You can be Catholic or Protestant in Ireland, and you can be called John.
Mm-hmm.
And that was why. I just wanted him. But it's also because John himself is a little sort of emotionally anemic, and that and those two things kind of slightly right. go together. And the son I called Philip, because I think of the L in Philip as skinny like him, you know, so.
And there's Philip the first,
yeah.
the founder, and Philip the child.
Yeah. Yeah.
Talk to me a little bit about the Connollys.
Oh, yeah. So the Connollys are the caretaker couple who live on the estate. And of course, as you all know, Donegal is Tír Conall. So they're sort of the embodiment of Donegal, this couple. And they're quite old. And they've been with the family forever. And Francis, who I spoke about in the reading, is the groundsman and gamekeeper. And his wife is the housekeeper. And they're by far the wisest people in the book, really. They just sort of quietly watch. And you can't help but think that if they'd been the ones to run the family therapy, everything would have been okay.
Yeah, there's a warmth about them. I mean, she's just so motherly.
Yeah.
And he is one of those beautifully realized, quiet characters. He says very little. He does very little in the book. There are very few explicit actions that he does, but they're all like just little tiny gestures in no theater or something. When he does something, it's hugely significant. He's a very, very skillful thing to the way that he's drawn.
Oh, thanks. I don't know a lot about him. I know it's a funny thing to say, but I don't know. He's the only character who I don't feel I know. But I know what all the characters would be doing right now if they were in Donegal in their house. You know, they live in my head, and I just took a slice of their life and told it to the reader. But Francis is the one person I don't really know. And have a huge amount of respect for,
mm-hmm.
you know. His wife, Mrs. Connolly, is a little bit based on my grandmother, my father's mother, who I was very, very close to. And she was very warm, and she was always making food for us. You know, Mrs. Connolly says food was the cure to all ills, and my gran, food was the cure to all ills. Yeah, but I think if they'd been allowed to have their say a little more, things wouldn't have gone anywhere near as wrong as they did, I think.
Right. Okay. Well, I could go on and on and ask you more questions. But I suppose, in deference to all the people who've come, we should throw it open. If anybody has, now would be a time. Yes. I'm going to repeat that just in case it doesn't carry back to the back. Just general question of favorite authors and influences, I think.
Living, I think, Marilyn Robinson. Her first novel, Housekeeping, which you might have read, it's this amazing book, I think, set in the Midwest, I think. But who cares what happens? I mean, the precision of her language is so beautiful. If I could write a sentence like her, you know, I could die tomorrow. So she's amazing. And actually, I was at an awards ceremony, not for me, for another writer friend who was receiving an award, and she was there, and she was coming up the stairs into the sort of cocktail reception afterwards, and I just stared at her open mouthed like a groupie, and she saw me sort of, and she kind of smiled like she knew that I worshipped her. So I love her. I think she has a new book coming out, by the way. Who else do I really love? I love John McGahern. The way that his work is so quiet, but so powerful. I wish I'd met him before he died.
Mm-hmm.
I love Seamus Heaney, of course. But who doesn't love Seamus Heaney? I just read Train Dreams by Dennis Johnson. And I never come across him before. I'm one of those people who loves reading so much that I like so many people. I was reading a book in bed last night, a really bad book. I won't tell you who it was by. But I was thinking, I love reading so much that I even like reading this really bad book. So I could really go on forever Joan Didion, I think Sentimental Journeys is, I think she's a genius. And there's going to be all these people I wish I'd said to you that I can't think of now when I go home later. Of course, you know, I was one of those people who got an English degree and was quite snobby about anyone who was actually alive. So honestly, I don't think I started reading living writers until about 10 years ago. So of course, up until then, you know, I loved all the, you know, the Jane Austens and the Charlotte Brontes and, okay, that's lots.
Cool. Another question? Yes, go ahead.
Was this book the catharsis for you?
Yeah, it was really cathartic, actually. Yeah, it really was. I mean, in two ways, partly because just formally, I think putting together, ordering this world and putting it together for me as someone who really sort of seeks order and is quite obsessive about order, it was very cathartic that way. But also it was really cathartic because I really worked out that the question I was asking about myself as an Irish person was the wrong question. And now I'm okay with myself, with my identity as an Irish person. And it was also cathartic because I think I really wanted the loss of my mother's family home was a big loss for us. And I think just writing an elegy for that house was really cathartic too. So yeah, I mean, writing's not supposed to be therapy, but I think it was a little bit.
Yes.
I don't think this gives anything away, but in the book there is a ballroom that is locked and the stairs aren't even really built to get to it, and it becomes very important to the plot, and a lot of sort of forbidden places become important. But I wonder how you decided to make the ballroom so inaccessible, like the idea of a house being in family for generations but no one ever bothering to build the staircase always fascinated me. How did you...
That's my editor, Laura, everyone, Little Brown. Thank you, Laura.
No problem.
So I suppose the ultimate antidote for me to your house being taken over is that you still have a secret place that you can go to. So I suppose I wanted the characters to have that secret place they could go to. I also really liked the idea... that you had the man who built the house, this very austere Presbyterian man who didn't believe in dancing, but was completely caught between his desire to impress his guests, but also, you know, not to offend his religion. And I sort of liked the idea that he would build this place to impress his guests, but at the last minute not build a stairs up to it because he thought he'd gone too far and he'd got too ostentatious and that people might dance and that might be terrible. Uh-huh. So that's where I came up with that.
Now, there's another two questions there at the back. Sir.
I really want to know the identity of the bad book that you've been reading. I've been kind of looking forward to this book writing for about 16 years, and you've been writing it for about 10. How much has the core of this book changed over that 10 years as you wrote? Was it a very different story when you first conceived it, or did you have the core of it at the very beginning?
I had the characters at the very beginning, and the characters have changed very little. But the story has changed a lot because it took me a long time to work out how to tell the story of these people. So I think the spirit of the book and the characters have been around since the very beginning. But the actual way that their lives are expressed has changed a lot over the course of drafting and redrafting and getting feedback from really clever people.
And there's another question right beside you. Yes.
I want to preface this by saying I drank too much wine, and you may have already answered this, but I left the book in this room.
Well,
one of the things I loved about your book was that you had the point of view of the different characters, the son, the father, the mother, and they all had such distinct voices, but still you had your voice arching throughout. So can you talk about how you, don't know, got in the head or, like, used language to represent each different point of view, but still be true to your own voice.
That was very eloquent for someone who's drunk a lot of wine. I think it really comes down to how long it took to write the book. I mean, I wrote the Philip sections when I was in my mid-20s, when I was much closer to his age. And I wrote his father's section next. But John is so sort of emotionally remote that I didn't need to get under his skin quite as much. And then when I was just that bit older, I was able to write an older woman, Marianne, the mother. So honestly, I think it wasn't that I was able to write all those bits at the same point in my life. I think it had to take me this long to write this book to be able to inhabit each of those. And I don't think I could go back and inhabit a child the same way as I could 10 years ago. So it's not amazing. It's not anything amazing on my part except the passage of time.
Yes, ma'am.
Have you attempted or aspired to essay any other forms of literature, playwriting or poetry?
College cured me of wanting to write essays. I have written some poetry, and I can't imagine writing plays because dialogue seems so difficult to me. What I love to do is description, and it seems so difficult to just... The only tool you have is to make people talk to each other. I can't imagine. And my husband was a screenwriter for a long time, and he helped me a lot with the dialogue in this book. And he's going to kill me for saying this, but in the early days, he joked that my dialogue, you know, characters would walk into a room and they'd say, "Hello, how are you?" And the other person would say, "I'm fine, thanks. How are you?" And Mike's knowledge as a screenwriter really, really helped me with my dialogue, but to do only dialogue, I can't think of anything more frightening.
How did college cure you of essays?
Because I think I just had to write so many for deadlines. I just don't see the essay as a fun thing for me to do. And as soon as, you know, I have to, perhaps have a thesis and back it up and all that kind of thing, where's the fun in that for me? That's why. Maybe when I'm older, I'll change my mind.
Another question? Yes, at the back.
Are you working on a new book now?
I am trying to. I'm having trouble where to set my new book. I know that I want to write a love story because this book is not so much a love story. So I want to give myself that challenge. I also want to write a book from a completely, completely non-Irish perspective because I've spent my whole adult life in the US now. So I'd love to write a book where, you know, if you picked it up and you hadn't read my bio, you wouldn't know I was from Ireland. You know, just for this one book, just as a sort of goal. And I'd also like to write a city book because this book is very much a country book. So I have the narrative. And I've written bits of it. I'm just a little stuck on where to set it at the moment. I had thought New York, but it's proving a difficult city to corral into fiction.
No? Oh, one.
Oh. What kept you going for 10 years on this book? What sort of encouragement or what sort of motivation? Did you ever put it down and start writing other things?
Absolutely, yeah.
Did you ever think maybe it was not meant to be?
Yes, I did. I mean, when I was in grad school, our teachers were very good at saying, you know, your first novel might end up in a drawer, you know, and that's okay. And the great thing I was saying to Kevin about being Irish is that you never expect anything good to happen in your life. So I had no expectations about it, and I had no expectations of getting published. I just was sort of taking it one step at a time. And I have a really good friend called Ryan Bartlemay, who lives in Chicago, who's a writer. And he says, you know, for him, writing is meditation. It's just the thing that he does every day to keep himself grounded and to think. And I think for me, writing was that too. So it was the thing I did to, you know, as it was my meditation. So I didn't always have a publishing goal, but I have a husband who's a writer, and he was really encouraging. And the great thing about going to graduate school for writing is that you have a little group of people, if you're lucky when you leave, who read your work and encourage you. And then if you're lucky, you get an agent. And when I got my agent, I suppose about 5 years ago now, you know, that was another little bit of encouragement. And then when the book sold, you know, that was encouragement too. So you kind of have people, you know, pulling you along when you think, you know, otherwise you might stop. And there are often times where if someone else didn't believe in you, you wouldn't keep going, I think.
Well, are you planning to speed it up on the next
one? Oh, I really hope so. I really hope so. I fear I'm not one of those people who's ever going to be able to write quickly. But I think I would write more fearlessly now, you know, and doubt myself a little bit less the next time around.
Yes.
So two very quick points, I hope. So you're talking about Mr. Connolly, so you talk about dead writers. I'm thinking the Tolstoy. He's very much he's like the peasant.
Oh, yes. Yeah. I was like, is there a Mr. Connolly in Tolstoy that I missed?
But when you said that, and you know, if everybody had listened to him and someone Tolstoy was the peasant.
Yeah.
And the second thing.
Yeah. A sort of Levin, more of Levin's perspective from Anna Karenina. Yeah, absolutely.
And then the second thing is, when you said about, you know, growing up in Ireland, when you had this dichotomy of what it was to be Irish, and growing up in New York, where I was Irish-American, first-generation American, we only knew one Irishness. Mm-hmm. And so when you said that, I thought, oh, my God, we were more Irish here than you were. We were more singularly Irish here than you were. And it was, you know, as I grew older, and I said, oh, yeah, there's that, and there's this. And but growing up, it was Irish. It was almost, you know, all whatever was in the music. Mm-hmm. And that was our Irishness.
Yeah,
we didn't have that dichotomy that you
I think we should come like bottles of wine with a vintage stamp that kind of dates you from when you or your people left. Because that's the... I mean, I... 1990s Irish. The things that have happened there, I'm aware of, but I don't think they form part of me, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, people whose family came here in 1860 have a very...
Not that old.
No, but, you know, that sense of identity gets passed down and it's not subject to the vagaries of what's actually going on in Ireland. So it can survive as more of a monolith. And also the huge complication of needing to forge an identity for yourself in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody was hyphenated something to keep your own sense of self and sense of your culture and your history intact.
You have to do it to survive, don't you? I mean, you can't. It's very hard. I'm sure there's no sort of expat community anywhere that has an incredibly nuanced idea of itself or the country it comes from. I mean, in order to survive, you've got to have quite clear and straightforward ideas about your identity as a community. Isn't that right? I mean, because nuance, whatever the opposite of bringing cohesion is, you know, it kind of breaks you up, right? So I think when you're creating a new community, how could you be anything other than monolithic, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Is there another question? Yes.
Oh, as you were reading, I kept thinking, as you were, Virginia Woolf, To the Lighthouse. It was the rhythm, the language, the back and forth, the rhythm up and then pulling back. Now, on the second, the work now that you're thinking in progress with New York City, do you think you'd be able to do that language, that rhythm, or is this the different? Just don't let me answer.
Yes, I do, and I think you might be putting your finger on why I'm having a hard time with it. Actually, I think you're right. I think the landscape demands different type. Different landscapes can demand different types of writing, and it's possible that I have to slightly rethink my prose for New York City. And it's possible I'm also not capable of that. I mean, I have a really strong feeling that you are the writer you are, and that there's nothing you can do about that. And it could be true that I'm not capable of writing about New York, and that's yet to be discovered. I mean, George Saunders says, style is what you do to keep from sucking. And it took me a really long time to work out what that meant. And what he really meant is, your style is what you do to keep, like, you capitalize on what you do best, and you have no choice. That's who you are as a writer. And it may well be that who I am as a writer does not include being able to describe New York. Stay tuned.
All right. Well, thank you, everybody. We will repair to the gallery.
This is Steve Blount thanking you for listening to the Live from Irish Arts Centre podcast, bringing you closer to live Irish arts in New York City. For more information, visit irisharts.org.